from the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. This is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonida Inge, and it's time for our series, HBCU 101. Need a good lawyer? Did you know historically black colleges and universities have produced 50% of all black lawyers in this country? Today, we speak with Patricia Timmons Goodson, Dean of the School of Law at North Carolina Central University, as it celebrates its 85th anniversary.
I am proud of the legacy of the law school. We have provided tremendous leadership throughout the state of North Carolina and this nation.
But first, we take you to an HBCU college showcase at the Emily K. Center in Durham. Most of these young people are in the 9th, 10th, and 11th grades, probably not thinking about law school yet. But going to college is definitely on their minds. Monica Allen of Durham is 16 years old. She walked into the Bull City and Black HBCU showcase sporting a t-shirt made especially for her, listing her favorite HBCUs.
And the choices I have on here is A&T, NCCU, Winston-Salem State, Shaw University, and Livingstone.
And my three main choices are Winston-Salem, A&T, and NCCU.
I mean, did you ever think of any predominantly white schools? You know, UNC Chapel Hill is nearby, Duke is nearby, NC State is nearby.
I thought about NC State a few times and UNC a few times, but I want to go to a HBCU. I've always wanted to go to an HBCU since I was little, so.
Monica is on it, and she's determined to continue her family's HBCU legacy. Eric Okaru of Clayton says he's glad to be in this space. The 15-year-old liked what he saw at Virginia State University. His mother, Kimberly Okaru, is an NC State graduate. She says there are no HBCU grads in their family. This is new for Eric.
He's very free-spirited, so I'm just watching him and letting him explore his options and so forth.
I'm kind of just looking around, seeing how I feel about everything. I'm really just like open-minded to everything right now.
This HBCU Showcase and Community Resource Fair was organized in part by Henry Capers Jr. Henry serves as post-secondary access advisor at the Emily K. Center. And he's a proud graduate of St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Henry, welcome to Due South.
Thank you so much. That was an amazing introduction. I love that. That was awesome.
You deserve it, Henry.
That was awesome.
No, congratulations on a job well done. You know, that was my first time attending one of those events at the Emily K. Center. And this year's Bull City and Black, it was such a delight. All I saw were smiles. I saw a lot of smiles. So how long has the center actually been hosting this college fair, this HBCU college fair?
That's an amazing question. We've been doing this now. This was our second annual HBCU showcase for Bull City and Black. And we were truly excited about trying to bring something new and something fresh to the community with our layout, with some of the organizations that were there and that were present. And it's an amazing opportunity to see how many people were truly affected by the work that we did.
So what are some of the goals of this event? You know, I can guess, you know, of course, you want young people to learn as much as possible about their college prospects. And because you want them, I guess, to go on to college, that is an option for them. One thing that was surprising, the kids were younger than I thought. They weren't coming out like, oh, I'm a senior, I got to figure something out really quick, or the 11th grade. No, they were like in the 9th grade.
Right. Yeah, organizationally, we had understood most seniors have made their decision, or at least have an idea about where they're planning to go for their next 4 years, if that is a community college, if that's a community college transfer pathway to a four-year institution, work or trade. And so we knew that we wanted to create something that was welcoming and receiving for that 9th through 11th grade group of students, because it's important now more than ever to start having those early conversations about college pathways, about creating what is next after a student graduates from high school.
I spoke to a few folks that really caught my eye, especially a young woman who had on a T-shirt with these question marks on it. Mm-hmm. And she had about six different HBCUs, like, which one?
Right.
So really, it was quite celebratory and serious at the same time, because mm-hmm. it was no question that she was going to college or even right. an HBCU. It was just like, which one?
Right. I think that's a proud moment to be able to share in that. I got a chance to talk to that young lady and her mother, mm-hmm. and I even joked with her. I said, hey, you don't have the right institution on
don't
there.
That sure.
You know, but as an HBCU graduate myself, it always does my heart justice to see how meaningful these experiences are for our prospective students. When they make our HBCUs their number one choice, or they make them their first choice, I know from lived experience how valuable those experiences really can be for our students. And I'm excited to see that. All those question marks, we'll soon have an answer. I challenged her. I said, when you figure out where you're going, you got to come back and tell us.
Please.
Because
do.
We want to celebrate in that success. That is just as exciting as getting accepted to UNC Chapel Hill or a Harvard or a Yale, in my opinion, by going to an HBCU. So
was an HBCU your first choice? Did you always know you were going to attend an HBCU?
That's a great question. I always knew I wanted to make sure my parents didn't have to pay for college. And I didn't quite know what that path looked like for me. But I did know that as long as I got a chance to play football while I was doing it, I was going to have a good time. And it seemed to be well into the recruitment process in my younger days. The HBCUs were really fond of me. And so I knew that an HBCU was going to be where I called home.
So you went to undergraduate school at St. Augustine's University.
Proud St. Augustine's Falcon.
Yes, a Falcon pride. And that's located in Raleigh. Mm-hmm. I want you to tell me a little bit about your experience there, but then I have to move into the conversation sure. that we keep hearing in the news, sure. you know, every week or so, that institution is struggling yeah. and struggling to hold on to its accreditation. And I'm sure you have some heartfelt conversation about yeah. that.
Yeah, I'm a proud St. Augustine's Falcon. I bleed the dark hue of the violet, the snow white lily blooms. And so I am honored because St. Augustine's University gave me an opportunity to do all of the things that I wanted to as a young child. That's go to school, make my dad proud because I'm Henry Capers Jr. My dad is Henry Sr. And so you always want to make dad proud. I got a chance to live out my college football dreams. I got a chance to even play college golf while I was there. I was the student government president, amongst so many other things. And so St. Augustine's University created that platform for me to be able to become who I am academically, socially, in many forms, led me to the work that I ultimately do now, which is that community engagement, which is involving myself in supporting the young people in our community.
So how does it feel hearing that? You know, I don't want to be the first to say that St. Augustine's could close in right. a few years or so, right. but the situation with the accreditation is really serious. Do you and your classmates still yeah. talk about that?
Yeah, it's heartbreaking to be frank. It's heartbreaking to see what's going on right now. I know St. Augustine's University has had its ups and downs over the last few years, and so I want to do what I can to help them. To get back to glory.
Well, before we wrap up our conversation, mm-hmm. I would like you to really talk about, I guess, because of your experience at St. Augustine's mm-hmm. and sadly because of what's happening now, I'm sure they had to bring some vigor to this college fair yeah. and the importance of that. So what do you tell people and even parents who may ask, you know, do we still need historically Black colleges and universities? You know, the world yeah. or the United States is more diverse and that Black students can attend any school. Mm-hmm. So how do you make an argument to stick with what you've always believed in about HBCUs.
Sure. The cultural relevancy of our HBCUs matters now more than ever. And I think more than ever, HBCUs fall in that category of giving a student an opportunity to experience the social aspects, the academic aspects of life the way they want to. So talking with a parent, they say, hey, my child is stuck between an HBCU or not going to an HBCU and choosing another institution. I would gladly tell them, hey, before you make any hard decision, go take some time and experience those campuses. Walk on the grass and get a chance to smell and eat in the cafeteria. See what the dorm life is like before you make your decision. One of the things I do know without a shadow of a doubt is that our faculty and staff at HBCUs are by far some of the best you'll find across the country. I have a mentor to this day. I remember as a freshman, walked up to my dorm room because I called myself oversleeping. And I got a really hard knock on the door. And when I opened the door, Moses T. Alexander Green told me, he said, you need to be in my class in 10 minutes and your breath better not stink.
Wow.
And in that moment, that trained and conditioned me to the expectation of life, to the expectation of what it is to be independent. And I'm not certain that all of our Black and brown students would always get that experience from an institution that doesn't directly concern and focus themselves for that student. So.
Well, Henry, thank you so much for being on Due South.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a pleasure.
As you heard, Henry Capers Jr. is a proud graduate of St. Augustine's University and serves as the Post-Secondary Access Advisor at the Emily Case Center in Durham. Coming up, we hear more about the current accreditation struggles at St. Augustine's University, and we get some perspective from the head of the Council for Higher Education Accreditation. You're listening to HBCU 101 on Due South. Welcome back to Due South and our series HBCU 101. I'm Leonita Inge. I received a news release from St. Augustine's University not too long ago. It addressed the university's fight to keep its doors open, pay its bills, while also fighting to keep its accreditation. The statement reads, "Our seniors will still graduate with a degree from an accredited institution, and our students will still receive college credit for their courses." The statement goes on to say, "SAU will remain accredited on probation for good cause throughout the arbitration process." Dr. Marcus H. Burgess, St. Augustine's interim president, has only been in charge a short while. This makes him the fourth president at this historically Black university in 5 years. Here is Burgess at a news conference on February 19, 2024.
The future of this exceptional institution requires a commitment of resources, strategic planning, and leadership. I am here today to address the crisis that threatens the continued viability of our university. But most importantly, we are plotting a pathway to emerge from the difficult issue that I have inherited months ago.
It's an emotional time for St. Augustine's and Burgess, and for the student body. Student body president Ariana White stood next to Burgess as he spoke. And then it was her turn.
SAU chose me, okay? So I love SAU, I love my HBCU. They kept me going. Actually, I'm gonna go a little bit into detail. When I was coming out of high school, SAU was actually like one of the colleges that accepted me due to my low high school GPA. So there were like other colleges that weren't willing to accept me. And SAU has shown me that it's not always about where you start, but it's always about like how you finish. And I love SAU, I love my HBCU.
Why the emotion?
You good. Three North Carolina-based historically Black colleges and universities have been in a fight to hold on to their accreditation in recent years: St. Augustine's, Bennett College, and Barber Scotia College. Here with me to unpack accreditation standards and why HBCUs in particular may be having trouble maintaining them is Dr. Cynthia Jackson Hammond. Dr. Jackson Hammond is president of the Council for Higher Education Accreditation. Welcome to Due South.
Well, thank you so very much for inviting me.
Well, I'd like to start with a brief explanation for our listeners regarding the role of the Council for Higher Education Accreditation.
The Council for Higher Education Accreditation actually is the result of a referendum by college presidents back in 1996 that suggested to the federal government that the issues of academic quality, academic integrity should rest with the university and not with the federal government.
So what protections does accreditation afford a college or university? You know, how long can any higher ed institution actually function without that?
That's a very good question, and I want to reframe it not from protection, but rather from opportunities. When you have an accredited institution, it sends a very clear message to the public that this is an institution of value, worth, and has met national standards for operations. And those national standards are measured by the varying accrediting agency that might go into that institution for review. There are institutional accreditors and there are program accreditors. So although we hear a lot about institutional accreditors, we also have program. So a program accreditor will review the education, the College of Education, or you might have a College of Business or a College of Engineering. All of those have program reviewers as well. By being accredited, if the institution is seeking federal support, that is a necessary measure for receiving federal dollars.
And that's what a few universities, colleges in North Carolina are running into, especially three historically Black colleges and universities in particular. The cycle of them being accredited or not or on probation has gone on for a long time.
It is an issue, but it's not just an issue for HBCUs. Many small colleges and universities experience limited accreditation reviews, or might I say probationary status for accreditation. The federal government has a set of standards. I shouldn't say standards, I should say compliance regulations that they expect the accreditor to go in and use as a possibility for measuring the efficiency of financial dollars. It can vary. You might be able to have a standard that you might not meet every part of that standard, but you might meet two or three parts of a standard for financial solvency. So it is a variation from university to university, and the accreditors do a really good job in assessing the accountability of that institution.
Does it matter which organization provides the accreditation for a college or university? Is it based on size at all?
No. An institution has to apply to an accrediting organization for candidacy to be reviewed. This is a voluntary process. And so each one of the accrediting organizations, especially the institutional accrediting organizations, must meet compliance standards with the federal government. Now, each one of those accrediting organizations have their own standards, but there are certainly some commonalities. For instance, faculty qualifications, financial accountability, student engagement, graduation rates. So all of those are general standards that compliance matrix that have to be met by the institution. But typically, those accrediting organizations are equal in their value and in their ability to do their job.
Mm. Well, Dr. Jackson Hammond, of course, you're president of the Council for Higher Education Accreditation, but I guess you know a lot of this firsthand. You know, you're a former president of Central State University, an HBCU in Ohio. And I'm told from some of your, you know, up here that you were very instrumental in definitely making sure that Central State during a set of years, you know, adhered to the standards for accreditation.
That's correct. And part of the accreditation process for any HBCU president is to use the model of continuous improvement. Too often, we think that, and I say we, I mean the public, think that once you meet the accreditation standards for that cycle, then it's a done deal. That's not the way it operates. Once you meet the standards, you are given a 7 to 10 year cycle. But during that cycle, the university is always looking for ways to continuously improve the operations of that university, which includes academic quality as well as financial stability. And that was something that was very important to me as the president of Central State University.
And a lot can happen during that cycle. I know in North Carolina, for the, I guess, public institutions, the cycle for renewal ranges from 5 to 10 years or so.
Yes.
But then you sometimes, I mean, we had a pandemic, you know, in the middle of some of these cycles.
Yeah. the world was changing rapidly. And although there were some leniencies in certain areas, the academic integrity of the university could not be compromised. So institutions, not just HBCUs, had to make a quick pivot to ensure that the academic quality was maintained. And of course, you know that institutions received some support of financial assistance from the federal government, and they had to use those funds efficiently to support academic integrity. But there was a lot of change, not only in HBCUs, but also in predominantly white institutions as well.
Well, is a degree valid if it is conferred by a college or university that has lost its accreditation, or they're in the process, are in the middle, you know, they're in the middle of trying to be reaccredited?
Yeah. Well, let me just say this. An institution, if it is on probation, is still accredited until it's not. Probation just simply means that the accrediting organization is giving the institution an opportunity to clarify, refine, and present new documentation to meet the standards. So probation is almost considered a pause. Let's pause and give you an opportunity to refine your responses. The question of valid is probably a very easy answer to say no. And then in the eyes of the public or employers, you have to ask, what do they mean by valid? So at some point, there has to be a level set. For instance, let me give you a very simplistic example. Mm-hmm. Cynthia Jackson Hammond decides to open up a university called Jackson University. Who is going to validate my organization as being valid other than me? And so if no one else sees
my... And that's not
my,
good enough.
that's absolutely. So I might get some students and charge an enormous amount of money, but it's only me who gives that validity. And that's not what higher education is about.
Well, how difficult is it to regain accreditation once it's lost?
It can be difficult, but it's a work of progress because you get an opportunity as an institution to look at where all the pitfalls may have been that leads the institution to not being accredited. It's an opportunity to redefine, to look at alternate ways of meeting the standards. And it's almost like regrowing a plant that you thought was not going to flourish anymore. It is difficult to some degree, but it's a worthwhile endeavor for continuous improvement. Because most of the time, when an institution loses its accreditation standards, a status, and it re-examines, it comes back stronger.
Well, I know that's what they're hoping for at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh, you know, one of the oldest HBCUs in the country. I think it was founded around 1867, in that range. Whenever I think of 1865, we know that was the end of the Civil War, so right, soon right after that. And I know your organization, your council represents, like you said, over 1,900 institutions, but I guess maintaining accreditation seems to really be a challenge for HBCUs, not just in North Carolina, but across mm-hmm. the country. So what might be some of those reasons?
Yeah. And if you've been reading any of the Chronicle of Higher Education articles, you will find that this is a time, especially after the pandemic, that many institutions have had to close programs because of limited enrollment or because a program in that institution may not be viable or there's not a great interest in that particular program. So although the pandemic may be open, universities are still readjusting. Now let's level set a little bit for historical Black colleges and university. From a missions point of view, HBCUs historically have never been resourced the way other institutions have been. So it's like you're always playing catch up. And you're playing catch up while still trying to preserve the mission of having opportunities available to underserved and underrepresented populations. So whereas a well-resourced institution may have all of the necessary resources to move forward, plus philanthropy and endowments, HBCUs may not have those same types of support systems. Nevertheless, they still must provide the same quality of services. So if you look at HBCU's financial historic financial records, you may find, and you, as I say, may loosely, you probably will find that the resources are not always there and have never been there. And a lot of the universities, the HBCUs in particular, rely on enrollment, just as any other universities. So if the enrollment of a university is 4,000 compared to another university that may be 40,000, you can see how the resources of enrollment might be different.
I definitely can, but I also still can't help but think about, you know, those students, like a young lady at St. Augustine. She says, you know, my grades just weren't where they were supposed to be to go to college, but this school took a chance on me. So it's not where you begin, it's where you end, she said.
Absolutely. And, you know, too often I personally think that students who go to HBCUs have been stigmatized by the public, and for whatever reason, to assume that they are not academically capable. But the issue is the sustainability of those students once they enter the halls of higher education.
Well, Dr. Cynthia Jackson-Hammond, thank you so much for being with me today. Dr. Cynthia Jackson-Hammond is president of the Council for Higher Education Accreditation. Thank you again.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Up next, North Carolina Central University's Law School celebrates its 85th anniversary. We'll hear from the school's dean next on Due South. This is Due South on WUNC, and we're back with our series HBCU 101. A tried-and-true way to recruit high school students for college is the college fair. Zora Cobb is a 16-year-old sophomore at City of Medicine Academy in Durham. I met her at the Bull City in Black HBCU Showcase a few weeks ago.
We talk about HBCUs like it's the next step, so I know when leaving high school that would be my next step. HBCUs really look out for people like me, people who look like me, people who have backgrounds like me, so it gives me a more home feel when I'm away from home.
To get the best and the brightest, HBCU leaders say they must recruit. I'm reminded of the late Frederick S. Humphreys, the former president of two HBCUs, Tennessee State University and Florida A&M University. He was credited with recruiting Black scholars like some schools recruit athletes. You know, sitting in the family living room and promising mamas and grandmamas he'll treat their child right. Another HBCU administrator continuing that legacy is Patricia Timmons Goodson, Dean of the North Carolina Central University School of Law. She's wrapping up this year's student recruitment season at one of the most racially and ethnically diverse law schools in the country. There are only a handful of law schools at HBCUs, which includes Howard University and the Thurgood Marshall School of Law at Texas Southern. NCCU's law school was founded in 1939 and is celebrating its 85th anniversary this year. I'm here with Patricia Timmons Goodson to discuss the school's enduring legacy. Dean Timmons Goodson, welcome to Due South.
It is so good to be with you, Leonita.
You know, you've had a long an illustrious career in state law. You served as an associate justice on the North Carolina Supreme Court. How does this role compare to those earlier experiences?
I'm not going to compare this experience, but what I will tell you, Leonita, is that it continues to provide an opportunity for me to impact the law. I sat as a jurist on the trial court and the appellate courts of North Carolina for 28 years. And during that time, I impacted the law, whether it was in an individual case or at the appellate level, a more wholesale effect on the law. But I want you to know that being the dean of North Carolina Central University affords yet another unique opportunity to impact the law. What better way to impact the law than to be responsible for and providing the leadership for our next generation of lawyers?
Some of our listeners may not know this part, or that the part of the reason that Central School of Law was founded was because UNC Chapel Hill would not admit Black students.
In March of 1939, the law school was chartered by the legislature, and that was because the only other state-supported law school legally could not admit African-American students. And so rather than violating the law or having Black students go to UNC, they created a law school for us. I want you to remember that this was during 1939. There was Hitler, the German army. World War II was waging, and it was in that climate that the law school was created. And Dr. Shepherd, the president at that time, looked around the school and identified a student that he thought was up to that task. And we can talk a little more about Mr. Bond later.
When you take a look at, say, the 2023 bank rate survey, you know, reported that HBCUs are responsible for producing 80% of Black judges, 50% of Black doctors, and 50% of Black lawyers in the U.S. So what are some of the reasons, say, that Black students opt for HBCU law school enrollment over, you know, alternatives? Because I guess times have changed. You can go to any law school you want to. But still, it seems HBCUs play a mighty role in producing professionals like lawyers.
Well, let me say first that I'm not surprised to learn the statistics that you just recited. I believe that there is something to be said about the nurturing and the encouragement and the space that allows one to get their footing and gain their confidence. And I believe that that's a huge role that our HBCUs play.
I've heard stories from not just my friends and classmates over the years, but they find it pretty challenging, especially if they're a first-generation college student, to actually complete law school and pass the bar without significant support. So what is it, what do you give your students at North Carolina Central, I guess especially those that you know are probably the first in their families to reach this milestone?
I think that the first thing that we do is identify with them. For example, I'm the first in my family to go to law school. And then in terms of identifying with them, we encourage. We know what we needed to get through the experience. And so I believe that our faculty and our staff embrace the students and encourage them. And often you don't know what you don't know. And so we make a special effort to expose our students so that they'll see the many options out there. Many come only knowing about Perry Mason and some of these other shows on television.
I love watching Perry Mason.
I did too. And at one point, that's about all I understood about the law, the criminal law. But there is so much more out there. That is really one of the great appeals about the study of law, the versatility of the degree. There is so much that you can do with it.
I have to backtrack a little because I would like to know more about why you even became a lawyer in the first place. You know, I know you grew up in South Carolina, and give us a little background.
Well, before Pat Timmons Goodson was a lawyer and a judge, I was a little girl born to an Army sergeant and his homemaker wife in Florence, South Carolina. Because Dad was in the military, we traveled a good bit. But I decided fairly early in life that I wanted to be a lawyer, not for any lofty goal. You know, I wasn't trying to break down the systemic segregation.
You weren't
the
little girl who had to be right all the time. Were you that little girl?
I was not that little girl that had to be right all the time, but I was that little girl that had big ears and heard in adult conversations as they discussed problems that eventually someone would say, you know, you need to go see a lawyer. And so I got in my little mind that lawyers were people that solved problems and that they were important and that they could help. And that's what I wanted to be.
And so now when we look at North Carolina Central University, we see the diversity there. And it's probably, I would assume, definitely quite diverse over its entire existence. And what are the school's like racial demographics? You know, how many young ladies are there? Or how many young men of color just like you?
Absolutely. The law school is very diverse. And I'm glad you pointed out that that is the way it has been for some time. And so we are one of two state-supported institutions. But for 85 years, we have been providing a quality legal education for our students. And so we have at North Carolina Central approximately 416 students. And at this time, about 29, almost 30% are male, and 69% or so are female. The students come from many states. We have about 98 Caucasians, 39 Hispanic students, 251 African Americans, 8 Asians, 14 Native Americans, and Alaskan. And so you see, we're very diverse. As I said, one of the most diverse in the country.
It almost, I'm not saying it quite balances out. It makes me think of just not only just the population of, say, the city of Durham, where it's located, for example, but I'm just thinking about the whole South in general, where we know, you know, this is where most African Americans in the country live. They live within just about
the South, yes.
Yes, about 7 or 8 states this way. So Central is reportedly also the most affordable law school in the state. Is that part of what may account for your longevity?
Well, I know that the leaders of our university system work very hard to keep costs down and to make it affordable. And North Carolina Central is one of the beneficiaries of that.
What are some other things that are attractive, you think, to this school that's going to help it stay here, what, another 85 years?
Absolutely. I would point out that we have a Tech and Policy Center. We're the only HBCU in the country that has such a thing. And you might ask, well, why is that important? Well, we all know that technology is huge, and it appears to be getting even larger. And often, African Americans and other minorities are left out of that space. And so through our Tech Center, we're able to train and educate lawyers that will be able to go back out into the community and to work in the area of technology. And so we're really excited about that program. But it marks just one way that North Carolina Central is keeping up with the times, and I would submit often ahead of, you know, our time.
One of my favorite stories over the years, especially dealing with North Carolina Central's law school, there was like a clinic that was held at a community center in Raleigh, and it was to help families with their wills. It was to help families, and even if it wasn't to help with the wills, it was just to make sure families had in writing, even how they wanted to be cared for, you know, after death. And so I wonder, is that also something that's very attractive about the law school, you know, the community work? How important is that?
Community work is extremely important. Let me point out that we have some 8 clinics.
Mm-hmm.
And the clinical experience allows our students to engage with the law in a practical way, a way in which they'll have to engage upon leaving the law school. You'll often hear it said that North Carolina Central produces practice-ready lawyers. This is one of the ways that that it does. But let me take you back in our history. The law school at one point during the time that it started, our graduates were not welcomed into the law firms across this state. What would happen is that you would normally be required to go out and to practice yourself. Mm-hmm. And so our early professors and administrators recognized that our students had to be practice ready when they left the law school because it was unlikely that they would be welcomed into a law firm where they could be trained. And so we were determined to train them so that when they left the law school, they literally could go to work. And so the clinics that we have include a criminal defense clinic, a family law clinic, a juvenile law clinic, pro bono clinic, veterans law clinic, just to name a few.
So you're still relatively new to the School of Law. You started your tenure as dean last year, 2023. So what are some things that you're still learning about Central and about the law school?
Yes, I am new. I believe that I have just finished 8 months. And so having not come from the Legal Academy, I have had to learn the ways of the Academy. And so I'm still very much learning that. And I'm still learning about the greatness of the law school and the work of its alumni.
Well, congratulations definitely on the 85th anniversary of NCCU's law school. It's a great time to really reflect on, you know, how far the School of Law has come and what the future holds for the institution. So any parting words, like what's in store for the school in the next few years? And it definitely seems that it's brighter for women and even women of color. I'm just going back to those numbers. A lot more females in the law school than males, and I think that's so across the country.
And I was going to say, and that's not just at North Carolina Central. It is across the country, more women. And our students, like I said, this is in many ways the best of times for our law school, with more families being more cost conscious. We're very appealing. When they look at what North Carolina Central alumni are doing and the great work that's being achieved in communities, they see North Carolina Central alumni at work. And so we have employers coming in large numbers seeking to hire our graduates because they know what our graduates can do because they look at our alumni. So it's an exciting time to be providing leadership for North Carolina Central University School of Law.
Well, again, thank you very much. Patricia Timmons Goodson is the Dean of North Carolina Central University School of Law. Dean, thank you for being on Due South.
Thank you so very much for having me.
You've been listening to HBCU 101 on Due South. Tell us what you think. Our email address is duesouth@wunc.org. Special thanks to producer Stacia Brown. I'm Leonita Inge. This is North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.